Studies at Marine Corps University presents Ottomans and Armenians, a Study in Counterinsurgency, a book discussion with Professor Edward J. Erickson, Marine Corps University. Professor Erickson will discuss his recent book, Ottomans and Armenians, a Study in Counterinsurgency, published by Palgrave Macmillan in November 2013. Although the Ottomans were among the most active practitioners of counterinsurgency campaigning in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, in the vast literature available on counterinsurgency to us in the early 21st century, there is very little scholarly analysis of how the Ottomans reacted to insurgency and then went about counterinsurgency. Professor Erickson will discuss the evolution of what he calls insurgency by committee in the core provinces of the Ottoman Empire. He will provide an overview of Ottoman counterinsurgency practices as the empire entered the period of the First World War, particularly with regard to activities of the Armenian Revolutionary Committees. Professor Erickson will establish a framework for understanding the reasons why the Ottoman government chose the partial relocation of the Armenian population in eastern Anatolia in 1915. Dr. Erickson is a professor of military history in the War Studies Department at the United States Marine Corps Command and Staff College, Quantico, Virginia. He is the author of 11 books and specializes in the history of the Ottoman Army during the 1876 to 1918 period. This lecture took place Friday, 14 November 2014, in the Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Or it does for these kind of things. And I appreciate that you're giving up a Friday afternoon to listen to something that I'm interested in. I would love to give this even to three people. It's something that I genuinely enjoy. That carving a niche thing, it's easy if you do something nobody else wants to do. So if you're going to pick Gettysburg or the Germans in World War II, good luck. If you want to pick something like this, it's wide open. I'm going to suggest at the end of this a great book for somebody here to write that is not yet written. And it could be either a book or a paper or an MMS topic or anything like that. Literally not been talked about. So I'll get to that. Ottomans and Armenians, a Study in Counterinsurgency. It's the title of this book from Palgrave Macmillan. I'm going to go through not every chapter of the book, but I'll highlight the various chapters as I go through this agenda of things to talk about. I'm going to put you back in high school for a few minutes and talk about history, because we come here with predispositions towards certain ideas in history that may or may not be true. And it's not sophomore, because I'll kind of drag it into the discussion. I'll talk about insurgency by committee and how the nature of insurgency in Europe changes after 1848, and what are the implications for the Ottoman Empire. Going to the First World War, this is the heart of the book. It's why do the Ottomans relocate Armenian civilians who are Ottoman citizens in the middle of a global war? And I'll get to my thesis on that. And then put the relocation in the context. This is where the new book needs to be written by somebody. Okay. I'm a military historian, especially World War I, especially the Ottoman Army. Combat effectiveness, innovation are topics, battlefield effectiveness that I have written extensively about. I'm not a genocide scholar. I'm not a social scientist. I'm not a scholar of oppressed minorities. So what I have to bring to the party on this particular subject is the experience of a practitioner. I've been out there doing the things most of you have done. I bring to this the experience of a military historian. So when I see a company symbol on a map, that resonates in my mind. I know the kind of weapons it carries. I know the number of people it has. I know that what a captain does and what a captain does not do. So I bring that experience into this study of what happens to the Armenians in 1915. Christmas is coming. 46 shopping days left till Christmas. throw down out there.
My wife.
There's all, you know, you got your father-in-law. You need the gift for your father-in-law. You've already given him, you know, the slow cooker and whatever. So I just throw it up there. Okay, history. It's never the truth. Not ever. These are some quotes. It is always constructed by people for an agenda. It can be manipulated. Is it manipulated intentionally by historians? Sometimes yes, sometimes not. We all try to strive for neutrality. It never, ever is 100%. So history is always written for a purpose. And it can be changed or altered. We look at Gettysburg today differently than we did 100 years ago. 100 years ago, Gettysburg was looked at as a battle that Lee lost because his subordinates failed him. And there's a phase of historiography where we go through where Lee lost because he failed his subordinates. His orders are screwed up. They're not comprehensive. He doesn't supervise Ewell and the boys as good as he should. We're now in a revisionist look at Gettysburg saying, well, you know, Lee did lose the battle, but Meade has an awful lot to do with it. So that's an example of evolving history that changes over time. Okay. When we look at history, who writes it and why? These Southern historians that are the lost cause advocates write about Lee in the 1870s, 1920s, in a way that we approach that differently today. It serves an interest. A lost cause school can serve Southern interests after Reconstruction in the United States. I'm going to talk a little bit about a guy named Tamim Ansari, who writes a book called Destiny Disrupted, and go through quickly how Western views of history are different than Middle Eastern views of history. This is a great book. And talk about a particular history. How does this paradigm affect history, and especially with regard to the relocations? That's what you took in high school, right? Roman Empire, Medieval Ages, Renaissance, Reformation, where's Martin Luther, Enlightenment, all that stuff. That's what you took in high school. High school curriculums in 50 states are designed to explain that. That's the purpose of the curriculum. Young Americans need to know why democracy works, why capitalism works, why human rights are important. All of those things track to explain that. Is that explicitly told to young Americans? No, but educators understand. Okay, same thing, different words, different arrangement. Ansari suggests, and I'm not an expert on Middle Eastern school curriculums, but this is what Ansari says Middle Eastern children look at in high school. Different words. We talk about the Renaissance and the Reformation, the Crusades. They call it catastrophe and permeation of the East by the West. Ansari says, this explains the Islamist reaction. So same events, different outcome, different writing of history. When you put these together, and line these up, Ansari's thesis is that you cannot understand the Islamist reaction without understanding their view of history. It's compelling to me. It's persuasive. I believe it's true. What's our problem with the Islamic State today? Part of it is, do we really understand who they are? Ansari would suggest that by your backgrounds, your education, the fact you're Americans, you cannot understand the Islamic State. So I think this is a compelling, persuasive thing and worthy of thinking. Okay, the relocation. In 1915, approximately, and the numbers range, 1.5 million down to 100,000. Reasonable estimates, maybe 350,000 Armenians, civilians, are removed from their homes and relocated to camps in the Euphrates Valley. There are five primary theses on how and why this happened. The first is ethnic homogenization. The Turks wanted to ethnically cleanse Eastern Anatolia, remove Armenians, and put in their place Turks. That's one thesis. Another is intent to destroy. This is the Armenian genocide argument, that the Turks intentionally set out to exterminate Armenians, and the outcome of relocation is extermination camps. That's a second. Cumulative radicalization. Donald Bloxham up in Edinburgh University says, you know, it's a result of global war. Things just lead to another. Global war sets in, you got the Russians, you got the English encouraging Armenians, and one thing leads to another, and small things all of a sudden erupt in a rebellion that the Turks deal with. Retaliation and justification. This is not so much pushed anymore, but an early Turkish interpretation was the Armenians are killing Muslims in numbers all over Eastern Anatolia. And in reaction to that, we've got to retaliate and then also move the people. The other one is, this is the current Turkish version of state security, that there is a genuine large rebellion that has to be dealt with. And it's dealt with in a very heavy-handed way, and we're sorry, we've apologized, but case closed. I don't think any of these fully explain the events. I think counterinsurgency is a sixth narrative. To me, it's the only one that takes all these five come from the same information, just like the curriculum. I think this is the one that fits best for me on why this happens. So I throw that out as kind of the introduction on history. That if you come in here with predispositions about thinking about these things, they may or may not be true. Parts of them may be true, parts not. So the Sick Man of Europe, arguably the most busy and effective practitioners of counterinsurgency, and that's a bad word to use because it doesn't exist in 1915 or 1870. If you read Caldwell, he talks about dealing with guerrillas or rebels. So the word itself isn't used. And it's always bad to try to retrofit modern technology, modern terminology on past events. I use the word because you all have an understanding. So the Ottomans don't use the word. They use the word rebellion. They use the word suppression of rebellion. But they are immersed and inundated with rebellions in their empire. They're the Sick Man of Europe. They're gradually imploding. They've got a primitive, agricultural, non-industrialized, illiterate, peasant-based, multilingual, multi-ethnic population. It's tough for them, and they're falling apart by 1914. They are in, and they wouldn't use this word, but this is the word you'll understand, a condition of persistent war. From about 1885, 1890, right on through to 1912, 1915, and really into World War I in terms of rebellions. There are Armenians who at different points rebel in the Ottoman Empire. There are people that call them Macedonians. Today you call them Bulgarians, mostly Macedonians. There are Kurds in rebellion at different points. Right? Right at the table. Yemen is a running sore for the world, for the Ottomans, for the British, the Egyptians, and today Yemen is constantly erupting in rebellion. Greeks, Arabs, the Libyans. So you'll recognize a lot of the current problems in the world today. You know, the Ottomans somehow had to deal with these, and they do. The Albanians. How do they deal with this? They've got an army. They've got capacity. I always tell my students, resources determine policy. If you have an army, if you've got 50 or 80 or 200,000 men, you'll send it in. So the Ottoman response to all these rebellions and in a condition of persistent war is to send in the army. Albania, they'll send in 10,000. In Yemen, they'll send in 35. Against the Macedonians in what's now northern Greece, southern Bulgaria, and Macedonia, they'll send in 100,000. So that is their response. That's how they deal historically with rebellion. The book has a chapter about rebellion and counterinsurgency in the periphery. Their response in the periphery is different than it is in the core provinces. There's another chapter about rebellion in the core provinces and how they respond to it. Macedonia in before 1912 being one of the core provinces. So there are different responses in different areas, all of which involve large numbers of people. It's a mess. Okay, insurgency by committee. The nature of insurgency, we often miss this in our studies of European history. The nature of insurgency in Europe changes after 1848. There are large-scale rebellions in Europe in 1830, and then the second wave even larger in 1848. And these are popular uprisings, driven by nationalism, driven by ethnic problems, driven by oppression. And you're familiar with this. They stop in 1848. That is, how come? Because they're brutally suppressed. The Concert of Europe is still working. Nation states have assets, big armies. They crush these rebellions and either kill or exile the people. So the French Revolution worked. Nothing really works after that time. The Greeks, it serves to a certain extent. But the nature of insurgency changes. It changes from large-scale popular rebellions to insurgency by committee. What do I mean by that? The nihilists, the anarchists, the Czechists, the Bolsheviks, the Black Hand of Serbian persuasion that kills the Archduke in Bosnia. These are all small, cellular, committee-like groups. I use the word committee because this is the word the church uses. They use the word committee. Means committee. So these small cellular organizations who operate by terror, they're not trying to overthrow and by popular rebellion. They aim at the overthrow of the state by terrorism. And terrorist acts will cause the government to overreact. And then maybe we can bring in the great powers to sort things out and give us independence. So there's a strategy. This technique survives to the present day. Al-Qaeda operates on this model. Hezbollah used to operate on this model. The two that are important to this, there are Armenian committees. The Armenian Revolutionary Federation, they're commonly called the ARF or the Dashnaks. There's another one called the Hunchaks. So they're active. The Internal Macedonian Committee, the IMRO, these are the guys in Macedonia. So in the Ottoman Empire, in the core areas, not the peripheral areas. The rebellions in the peripheral areas still tend to be tribal, tend to be leader-centric. The Imam Idris rebellion in Yemen, for example, leader-centric and tribal. So in the core areas, which are more or less European, you see the rise of these committees. They tend to be Marxist. They tend to be socialist. They tend to follow that kind of a political orientation with the objective of independence for their particular group. I get it that everybody who's rebelling in the Ottoman Empire has grievances. They are all oppressed minorities. There's certainly no justification for the Ottomans in a larger sense of actually having oppressed people in the empire. So I get it that if I were an Armenian, I'd want to be in a committee. So would you. I mean, this is the American foundation mythology, rebellion against oppression. And I just throw that out, that I'm not advancing a pro-Ottoman agenda that explains success in counterinsurgency. Okay, the ARF, they've got manifestos, the Hunchaks do too. My take on the committees is not the Turkish take, this is the Armenian take, and what I've used in the book are the records and views of the great Armenian writers that write about the committees, Ruiz Nalbandian, Prach-Nubian, Dikran Kalibian. So there are a number of Armenian authors that write about these committees and explicit manifesto, and that's the word that they use, and they are propaganda by deed. We're going to spread the word by terrorism. The deed speaks for itself. That deed could be a bombing, could be an assassination, could be an interdiction of a railroad. It could be the burning of a police station. All those things in combination send the word and attract recruits, attract support to our organization. They have internal and external apparatus. The internal to the Ottoman Empire, they are secret. They're cellular. There's six guys in Sivas, and they don't know who the 10 guys are over in Arizona because they're by design compartmentalized. You understand it, and you know why. this comes out of this insurgency by committee paradigm that we see rising in the last half of the 19th century. The secret committees tend to be involved in military activities. The non-secret committees tend to be involved in humanitarian things and writing and literature, almost like Hezbollah and Hamas, and to a certain extent the Islamic State does today in those locations. So the cellular architecture, highly organized. This is not some catch-as-catch-can. There's a high degree of organization here. The external committees, the external apparatus for the Armenians, for example, have offices in Boston and in Paris and in Cairo, and they collect money for purposes of all the lines. So there are financial considerations that this architecture enables as well. What do they use the money for? They buy a lot of weapons. At different points, Europe is awash in weapons. When does the United States, when does the average American buy a gun? It's after the Civil War, because that's when the guns become available in large numbers cheap. When do these people become armed? Europe is a sine curve. After the War of 1877, there are surplus military weapons available. After the War of the Balkan Wars of 1912, there are weapons available. The external apparatus buys stuff. They buy Mausers, they buy pistols, they buy amphibians, and they smuggle them in to the Ottoman Empire. These are the Eastern smuggling routes. These are well documented. There are also smuggling routes near Istanbul. In Tekirdağ, the port of Tekirdağ. So this is coming in from different areas. What are the numbers like? 100 here, 100 there, sometimes as many as 1,000, but it's cumulative. They're brought in, they're cashed, they're stockpiled in places where the Armenian committees are active. That's what they look like. Kind of a bourgeois aspect. This is the Armenian committee, I think, from the city of Van. And I say that because we know that the rebellion in Van that occurs in 1915 uses the Mauser pistol, that signature Mauser pistol. This thing can have a stock put on it, and it becomes almost a carbine. It's a semi-automatic pistol. So those are some of the weapons. Those guys, they're not peasants in villages. They're not tribal. They are bourgeoisie. They are educated professionals. They're literate. Who runs the Armenian committees? Who runs any of these committees? Who runs the Black Hand in Serbia? Not Princip, the guy that pulls the trigger, but who runs it? These are educated people. They're professional people. They're lawyers. They're doctors. They are businessmen. They are priests in some cases. So the leadership of the Armenian committees tends to be profoundly bourgeoisie. And I'll come back to this point in just a minute. The interesting picture. I thought for a while that was a female, but in fact it's just a androgynous guy. it is a male-dominated woman. If there are Armenian women in the committees, I'm not aware of them, although when the violence breaks out, and as we see the Kurdish women today in Kobani, there are Armenian women who will pick up the guns and help fight. And that's a well-documented phenomenon. Okay, summary. They're organized. They're heavily armed. They're committed to revolutionary goals by any means. Terrorism, assassination, that's in their manifestos. That's their track record. We know that factually from looking at history. They have external support. The leadership includes intelligentsia and nobles. This will come back to roost on the 24th of April, 1915, when 300 Armenian men are taken out of Istanbul, who are this crowd. They're university professors, they're doctors, they're businessmen, they're lawyers, they're priests. It's profiled. The Ottomans know who leads this. They don't know quite who they all are. But if I pick up 300 men and take them away to a prison, and then I screen them and call them, well, like Guantanamo, I'll send half back. And the other half, I'm pretty sure, are the leadership. This is an important part. This is where I've changed my view. I used to think this was a widespread thing. I used to think there are a lot more Armenians involved in this than there were. I used to think that the rebellion itself was bigger. My book speaks to this, that membership was limited. How many Armenians live in the Ottoman Empire? Maybe 1.5 million. How many are involved in the committees? It's in the thousands. it's not representative of the population. Most Armenians were not members. Most Armenians are loyal citizens. There are Armenians in the Ottoman army who served until 1918. Lots of them, lots of them. So this is an important point, that the committees don't represent the Armenian population. Okay, where do they live? Most of them, the population that gets relocated lives in eastern Anatolia. They are distributed throughout the empire in the four provinces everywhere. They tend to cluster in eastern Anatolia and in what's now the Istanbul Turkish Straits area. Those are the main concentrations of these people. Kind of switch now to the Ottoman army. That's what I'm going to do is to kind of run through this 40-45 minutes, and then if you have questions, we'll have a Q&A. So that's kind of a glimpse into the population and the committee architecture of the Armenians who live in the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman army, kind of switch tack here, and who are that's what they look like. They're better than they look. They're tough. If you read about Gallipoli, these are tough men. They are well led. There's a reason why the British lose at Gallipoli, and it isn't simply because the British are clumsy or inept. They're fighting these people. These are Turks, Arabs, Armenians, and they're tough. They're well led. They look ragged. And it's almost like looking at ISIS. You look at the Islamic State. They look like knuckleheads. They're running around in rags and shooting up everything. But I would submit that's a cosmetic approach. There's something about the Islamic State. Those boys are tough, and they're well led. I don't care what anybody says. They are well led. There's something behind the Islamic State that we don't understand, and we are seduced by the way they look. Same thing happens with the Ottomans. August 1914, Europe goes to war. The Ottomans are not in the war until November. But as happens all over Europe, what happens to the garrisons within the empire? Just as in Germany or France, they go to the frontier to concentrate for the war plan, so does the same thing happen in the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman army, which is distributed in the same way the German, French, or British army is, all across the country in garrisons, the French and German word is caserne. So too is the Ottoman army. So they start to deploy to the frontiers. And what happens when they enter the war in November and then later in December is the army's concentrated on the frontier. Again, they're up here because the war plan doesn't match political reality. They think they're going to go to war in August against the Bulgarians, not against the British, French, or Russians. They wind up here with the bulk of their army. They have another element facing the Russians in Caucasia. And then, to their surprise, the British are their adversary. They're a historical friend of the Ottomans. So they wind up sending the remaining parts of the army to Mesopotamia and Palestine. So that's what happens to the Ottoman army. It is on the frontiers. It's taken out of garrison and deployed to the frontiers. Okay, back to the Armenian committees. Going into the spring of 1915, they've been tracking these committees for 30 years. So the Ottomans know a lot about them. They've got copies of the manifestos. They've got captured weapons. They've got informers. They understand the nature and context of the committees. The ones in the Macedonia have been wildly successful in bringing in the great powers, and that's now a loss. The young Turks themselves that are running Turkey, Enver Pasha, Talat Pasha, Jamal, they are all members of the Committee of Union and Progress, which itself starts as a revolutionary committee. So the people running Turkey used to do this themselves and were effective and successful. There's been a number of congresses by the Armenians, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, the latest one being in Erzurum. The Turks have spies and informants. And they know that at that Congress, although most of the Armenians say, you know, we need to just be kind of watchful and neutral. If war breaks out, there's a vocal and hardcore group that advocates immediate rebellion. Those people go to Russia. The hardcore guys leave the empire, go to Russia, and they form volunteer regiments called Druzhiny. Regiment is probably too organized a term. Legion might be better. So there are four of these, led by notable Armenian Ottoman citizens, most famous of which, Armen Garo. There are a number of people like this who go to Russia and form these regiments. There's a quasi-war in the northeastern frontier. On that Russian frontier, there are Armenians coming across. There are Ottomans and Turks going across their side, trying to raise rebellion. So there's a genuine quasi-war going on. Acts of terrorism are escalating. I'll show you a map in just a second and explain this. They know the British are coming. They know since February 18th, 1915, that the British are coming, and their intelligence is good. The Ottomans have better humant. They would never use that. They would use the word informer, spies. But as you know that term, humant, the Ottomans are good at that. They've got a successful track record of gathering information. And one of the things they know is that Gallipoli is about to happen. This is important, because I'll come back to this. They also understand the weaknesses of the army that's sitting on the Caucasian frontier in terms of logistics. Okay. Lines of communication. I'm fortunate that I have a crowd like this, but you understand it. You know what lines of communication mean. You understand that to supply the armies on the frontier, that the lines of communication are important. What happens is that the lines of communication from January to April 1915, and even before that, start to be interdicted by different groups of Armenians. Some are deserters from the army, some are genuine, authentic committee members, some are guerrillas sent in by the Russians. But there are a number of interdictions. What do I mean by that? Bombings of bridges, cutting the telegraph lines, knocking out the local outposts, that kind of stuff. That's happening all along. There's a record of this in the Ottoman archives. There's a record of this in the British and Russian archives. I just point out, you're familiar with the Schlieffen Plan. And when the Germans in 1914 go farther and farther and farther away from their railheads, it's a problem. Well, these boys up here in Erzurum on the Caucasian frontier are about 400 miles from their railheads. Everything from the railhead has got to be brought on horseback. In the whole Third Army area on the Caucasian frontier, there are six automobiles, that's it. Everything else is an ox cart or a horse-drawn vehicle. 14,000 men and 22 or 23,000 horses, oxes, and mules transport stuff up to the front. They can't use the oceans because the British blockade is clamped down tight. So, what happens? Where do you put a pin in the wall and say this thing breaks out in a big way? In early April, in the city of Van, on the eastern frontier, Armenian committeemen. The Armenians say it's a reaction to the Turkish atrocities. The Turks say the Armenians started it deliberately. I don't know. They seize the city of Van. There's Van, right there. There's the front line. From the outside, the Druzhiny come in with a Russian army and link up and liberate the city of Van. The Turks lose this. The Turks lose this. Is this deliberate or by design? I haven't found a smoking gun, but it sure looks it to me. What happens? That's a big deal in World War I. Success is measured in yards, in meters. This is an 80-mile chunk that's gouged out of the front at Van. Is it a rebellion? Our ambassador in Istanbul, Morgenthau, thinks it is. He thinks it's a rebellion. He uses the word rebellion. He uses the word insurgents. This comes out of the National Archives, in College Park. So this is not a unilateral opinion. The French, the Turks, the Russians, the English, all categorize this as a rebellion in April. The German archives are explicit, from von Langenheim in Istanbul to Berlin. They use this word over and over. They also use the word massacre and atrocity. So I want to separate those two things. Everybody in the world knows at the same time this is happening that there are a lot of massacres and atrocities. That's a separate issue for this. Okay. What's the potential for strategic disaster? What happens if what happened in Aaron and in Van happens in other places? What happens if the rear of the Third Army, the red blob, the red gooseneck, what happens if that rear area is slowly and sequentially conquered by Russians and Armenians? Then you will lose the whole Third Army. Before you know it, the Russians are on the Mediterranean, which, like the great game in Asia, has always been a Russian objective. Whether the Russians wind up here or they wind up here is inconsequential. So this fits into everybody's understanding of the great game and Russian strategic design. Okay, that's the dilemma. How have they reacted before? They sent in the army. The insurgency has sent in the army. The problem is the army's gone on the frontiers. Who's left in the interior? Training battalions, logistical support structures, gendarme guards at every bridge. So the capability that formerly was applicable to insurgency does not exist. What can you do? What could anybody do? I go back to this resource of determined policy. I tell my students this all the time. It doesn't matter if there was a genuine Armenian rebellion. It doesn't, if your wife thinks you're having an affair with a blonde pole dancer next door, it doesn't matter if it's true. The effect on you is the same. It doesn't matter if the Armenians are genuinely in rebellion. The Turks, the high command, the people making decisions believe that they are. And as our friend General von Reiber says, I love this quote, the choice of explanation determines the nature of the problem's resolution. That's how the Turkish administration and high command chooses to interpret this. Was it a rebellion or not? I think it was. Other people think not. Doesn't matter. They react to it as if it was. Okay. 26 men. They start to take action. Not every Armenian. Some Armenians are doing these kind of things. They're helping the enemy. They're obstructing logistics. They're denying. They're collaborating with the enemy. So this is the problem statement in modern terms. That's the problem statement. Some of the Armenians. What do we do? Okay. This is it. This is what they do. This is the famous relocation memorandum. This is what we're going to do. We're going to separate insurgents, guerrillas, from the population. And we're going to limit that to a certain area. So, problem statement, that's the solution. This is a Caldwell solution. Caldwell talks about this. So this is relocation. What's it look like spatially on the ground? That's it. Where are the Armenians relocated from en masse? These places from the directive. Sure, there are Armenians taken out of these places and all over, but collectively en masse, by January 1916, those provinces have 1% of their original Armenian population left. Okay, what's the outcome? We forget or ignore that in 1918, there are still 350 to 400,000 Armenians left in the empire. There are still thousands of Armenian officers serving in the Ottoman army. There are still battalions of Armenian construction people in the labor battalions working in the Ottoman army. So a lot of these people left. There are also a significant number who have fled to Russia. Same thing happening in Syria and Turkey today. The Turks have anywhere up to 1 million refugees. So these people, a lot of them go to be refugees, a significant number. I don't know how many. The Armenian lobby would tell you 1.5 million go to camps, concentration camps at Deir el-Zor in Syria, where they are exterminated. So a significant number wind up, the people from these provinces wind up here. That's where they wind up. What's the context? Men of my age, in my generation, they have read Longfellow's poem, Evangeline. And we remember some of the signature first lines of literature. Water, water everywhere, nor but a drop to drink. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. This is the forest primeval. If you're familiar with that phrase, it comes from Longfellow's poem, Evangeline. What's that about? That's about counterinsurgency and relocation. It's a love story, but how does Evangeline get to Louisiana? How does she get to where she is? It's because the British, on August 10th, 1755, take out 12,000 Acadians, they're called, the inhabitants of the maritime provinces in Canada, where they are a threat. There's an active French insurgency going on, threatening the fortress of Louisbourg, which has been captured by the British. So this is an early application of the relocation of insurgents. You go to Nova Scotia, you can see monuments. Nobody up there is French anymore. The French still live in Quebec, but they're all English speakers up there. The one that's closest to the action in 1915 is the famous Boer War. It's not counterinsurgency. It's a counter-guerrilla. So it's different in the kind of war it is. The outcome is that the Boers are evacuated, relocated, taken out of their homes, 100,000 people, and sent to the British originate this word, concentration camp, concentration camps. And like Andersonville Prison, or Libby Prison, or Elmira Prison in our own Civil War, these concentration camps are without much medical attention. They're not particularly sanitary. They look organized, and they are to a certain extent, but sanitary conditions are abysmal. Malnutrition is a problem. There's a poor child. And thousands of these people die. It becomes a cause celebre of the age. Britain, in 1901, the papers are awash with indignation. In the same way some of our citizens are indignant about Guantanamo, so too are many British citizens indignant about this. And they finally fix it after the war. Okay, here's where the book needs to be written. Relocation as a counterinsurgency strategy. The context that the relocation of Armenians nests in looks like this. Acadia has happened. Do they know about it? Probably not. They do know about, the Ottomans do know about Spain, the United States, and Britain. And they know about the relocation of people. The famous signature event is Butcher Wiley, they call him, the guy in Cuba, who relocates a bunch of Cubans. And he calls it La Concentración. I can't say the word. La Concentración. I'm not a Spanish linguist. They know about that. We relocate people on Samar in what we call zones of protection. There's a famous one we have, Wall. The British, the concentration camps. Now, this is the pre-bomb. Nobody has doctrine. So this is what would you call best practices, for want of a better word? What works? Nobody has doctrine, really, until the 1990s. And today, nobody's doctrine includes relocation. But yet, all of these relocations occur. So are the Ottomans following a doctrinal template? No, they're not. But they study counterinsurgency. The war college graduates have studied the Boer War. They had contact with the Brits and the Germans. So there's a commonly understood Caldwell. Our friend Caldwell writes a book called Small Wars. And Caldwell speaks to this. There's a Caldwell. Caldwell's been translated into German, not into Ottoman, but all the Turkish war college graduates read German. So they know about it. We continue on. And look at the names. Zones of protection, concentration camps, exile. Something like 300,000 Jews are exiled from what's now Belarus, Poland, and Ukraine, because for the Russian Tsar's high command, they think the Jews are sympathetic to the Germans. Many of them have German names. The Ukrainian Jews are Germanic. They're relocated in the opposite direction. Lots of them die. The internment camps are the Japanese, the loyal American American residents in California, are they a threat? Well, they're not. Doesn't matter. The administration, FDR's administration, believes they might be a threat, and they're relocated to Nevada. Famously, we all know about the BRICS plan, the new villages. Separate ethnic Chinese, take them out of their homes, put them in new villages. And we all know the story here. The largest one that I think I know about is the Quadrilateral. The French did the same thing out here. 800,000 people. Amazing. My take on protecting hamlets is a relocation. It is of a sort. In my view, protecting hamlets in Vietnam achieved the same purpose. They've got guards, they've got village guards, but you can't go out and you can only have X amount of food. purpose of protecting hamlets. They are really relocation sites, but the object is not simply to protect the inhabitants of the village, but to cut off sources of supply for Viet Cong guerrillas. So there is a track record. There's nothing out there on this linking this stuff together. There's no book, there's no articles, there's no MMS topic paper. So this is a wide open opportunity. I would do it, but I've got time. I've got six other projects that would interfere with it. Different than these. The word concentration camp, that's what you're thinking of. Gas chambers and SS troops and people getting off boxcars and separation of women and children and all those things. Okay? So this is different. The explicit purpose of none of these is extermination. Although the effect is the same, in many cases, lots of people die. Just like Andersonville and Libby Prison and Elmhart and malnutrition, medical problems, cholera, dysentery, all of this. But they're different. Okay. At the end, questions I can't answer, but I don't know the answer to. These are the controversial, this is a huge thing between the Armenian lobby, the country of Armenia, and the modern Turkish Republic. Was it a genocide? Was it deliberate? Was there intent? How many people died? 1.5 million or 100,000? So these are questions for other people besides me. And I have opinions on these, but I'm really not the specialist on these particular questions. What could I tell you? There were Armenian committees, heavily armed, in key locations, prepared to fight, and they do in some cases, and a lot of bad things happen. They are a threat to Ottoman national security. This is an audience. When I give this pitch to civilians, I've got to explain the rear of the army. It's not a line. It's not like the rear of Ed Erickson. The rear of the army has hospitals and logistics and food stockpiles and transportation buildings. That rear area is in jeopardy. It is a threat. It metastasizes a man. And the Ottomans don't wait for the threat to metastasize into a region-wide conflagration. They take out the Armenians before anything happens. So I'm convinced that's a true statement. Russia, Britain, and France, they conspire with the Armenian committees. They encourage the Armenian committees. They inflame the situation. They actively support the revolutionary ideas of the Armenian committees. The Turk archives speak to this, the French, the British, the Russian, the American archives speak to this. Observers in Eastern Anatolia speak to this. So this is also a true statement. Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia works. And people like, he's not the only one. But what the British and the French are trying to do with the Armenians in the Mediterranean works in Arabia. They send in Lawrence and a couple other guys, and they've got bags of gold and machine guns, and they energize the rebellion of Ibn Saud and Hussein, and off they go. So the British have kind of a mixed track record. Works in Arabia, doesn't work here. So those are at the heart of my beliefs about this problem. Okay. Massacres. Slaughter of people. This does not explain what happens to all those Armenians who go into that relocation pipeline. What happens when you're taken out of your home and put in a convoy going to camp? Well, thousands and thousands and thousands of these people are raped and murdered and slaughtered and removed. Is that a genocide? I don't know. That's not my area. I can tell you that there are numbers of genocidal acts committed by individuals in that pipeline. I can also tell you that 1,600 Ottoman soldiers, gendarmes, public officials, governors are brought to trial in 1916 for these offenses. Some are executed, some are imprisoned, some are just simply let go. So I'm not justifying those crimes or that punishment. But my area is exclusively answers the question, why did they move these people to begin with? These are my takeaways that I tell civilians. I talk about history, purpose, and agenda. this is going to be a big deal in April 2015. It is a centenary. The date the Armenians pick as the start of this thing is 24 April, when they remove 300 intelligentsia from Istanbul. That is a huge thing for the Armenians. It's the day before the Gallipoli centenary. But if you're watching the papers, you'll probably see several attempts to bring into Congress a congressional resolution to classify this as a genocide in the same way that's happened in France and Austria. I think there's middle ground. I think the Armenian position is extreme, the Turkish position is extreme. There's something in the middle. If it's not genocide, what is it? The Turks have to explain what did happen in some way. There's a reason why all these thousands, I think 300,000 people, 1.5 million down to 50,000, depending if you're Armenian or Turk. I think 350,000 people died. That's a lot of people. They've got to be explained. And as I tell my students and anybody that listens to me, don't just listen to Ed's book. You know, read widely, read as much as you. If you're interested in this, read the Armenian text, read the Turkish text, and come to some understanding. That concludes the presentation. And I'm more than happy to take questions.
Sure. I got a question. You're talking about insurgency by committee. Is there kind of a committee of committees, and by that I mean like interrelationship between those different ethnicities? And if so, is there like any lessons today that you can see with IS and the Free Syrian Army and how these different insurgent activities interrelate?
Among the Macedonians and among the Armenians, there are competing committees. A committee will start, and then there'll be one or two guys who are pissed off, they don't have a position they want, or the manifesto's not right, and they'll form another committee. And they do that. At certain points, they will come and work together. And then almost in every case, they'll have philosophical disagreements about what they ought to do, and they'll break apart. So that's not a good answer to your question. They operate much like the rebel groups in Syria. At certain points, they don't act in concert. They act intermittently, they act sporadically. So that's about all I can say. Bill?
I really like your point about the movement away from the old term rebel and then into insurgencies. And that's a funny thing. I mean, we don't call the Confederates in the Civil War, from the other persuasion, we generally call them Reds or Rebels or something like that, not insurgents. And then you get all that David Galula stuff, like his paper at Harvard, when a new thing is crept in, like an insurgency takes on a different flavor. It's got some kind of outside support. It may have some evil, not just methodology, but like you laid out the committees and so forth. And so for whatever reason, we decided to do away with old words for that. Guerrilla stays with us, certainly, but counter-guerrilla becomes counter-insurgency, because it takes on more of a full political thing. And I'm not sure why all that is. I looked this up. I had nothing to do one day. I traced the word. I mean, some of those words go back to like Norman court French back in the Middle Ages and so forth. But they become something new. In the 19th century and the 20th century, they take on a new thing. And you've done your customary great job to lay that out.
The vocabulary is important. Many of you were in Iraq in 04 and 05, and will remember that the administration used the words dead-ender and insurgent, and that defined the approach at that time. There were many people in Iraq on the ground who said, you know, it's more than that. It really is a civil war, and there are people out here who aren't dead-enders, and there are people out here who aren't insurgents. There are people out here who are fighting their neighbors, and it's a civil war. And that complex relationship was not embraced by the United States until late 06 and early 07. And how we finally interpreted that war, we used all those things. We used insurgent, dead under, guerrilla, and rebel. And really was not necessarily a hybrid war, but it was certainly a war that had layers. There were dead enders, there were insurgents, there were civil war, neighbor on neighbor thing. I mean, all those things, but I'm glad you brought that up. The vocabulary this problematic. We have sometimes asked my students, well, what's a rebel and what's an insurgent? Is there a difference? Is there a difference between, does it matter? I think it certainly did matter in Iraq in 04 and 05 when we were trying to struggle with defining that role. I'm glad you brought that up. Any other questions?
On your list that you had of the different, concentration camps, I noticed one that wasn't there, but I kept thinking of as you were talking, is the displacement of Native Americans in the U.S.
You can make a case that the Dawes Severalty Act in 1877 accomplishes the same thing. The Trail of Tears from Georgia, the Cherokees from Georgia to Oklahoma, certainly 90% of them died. This is a genocide. Did Andrew Jackson and his administration decide to eliminate, eradicate the Cherokees? A Native American approach today would be, yes, it was a genocide. Historically, probably not. How do we account for 90% of them dying while they're going from Georgia to Oklahoma with very little food, no transportation, no medical assistance, and they're walking 1,000 miles? It takes me a year. You know, and how can they not die? Is it a crime of commission? No. Is it a crime of omission or neglect? Certainly. Should the Jackson administration have anticipated that? Maybe. You know, those are questions for not for historians, but for advocates. The Dawes Severalty Act of 1877 formally establishes a network of, in addition to reservations in our country, taking out the sons of chiefs and daughters of chiefs and sending them to Carlisle Barracks to be turned into little Americans. If you've been to the War College at Carlisle Barracks, in the commissary in PX, there are these before and after pictures. There's a before picture of a whole bunch of little angry Indians wearing buckskins and feathers. And then there's the after picture, after they've gone through the Indian school that Jim Thorpe went to, where they are now little Americans. And the girls have gingham dresses. And the men are in the guys are in suits and they got haircuts. And in each set of pictures there, nobody smiled. It's tragic. I'm glad that's a good question. Stephanie, is that?
No, my name is Elise Campbell with the Public Affairs Office.
You look like somebody who used to be here at the GRC. Please.
No, well, I'm in the blended command and staff program. But I was wondering, given the interconnectedness of the world with the internet and media today, do you think that this is a viable option for governments who are facing an insurgency now?
I think structurally what we did in Baghdad in 08 was not relocation, but was compartmentalization. We built T-walls everywhere. There was this importance of separating guerrillas and insurgents from the population. Is it possible, given certainly from a Western view, is relocation viable anymore? Certainly not. Would it work? Probably. Baghdad, we intentionally compartmentalized that city and accomplish the same thing. I think we can do it today without moving people. I think that's what Protected Hamlets do in Vietnam. I think it's what we did in Baghdad. It's one of these, relocation is kind of like the word we must not say. That's a good question. I don't think we'll ever see it in coin doctrine. That's a great question. Another question, yes sir.
How much the decision of Ottomans get the desire to end?
Can you say again?
How much the decision to relocate the Armenians get made the desired end? I mean, what were the consequences? Did the attacks minimize?
Yes, yeah. I spent quite a bit of time in the book on what happens after the people relocate. After the people are relocated, there are still guerrilla bands and insurgent bands out there hiding and in the headlines. The Ottomans then redeploy several divisions from different fronts to deal with this, and they slowly take these people out. The relocations themselves were completed by the fall of 1915. By January, they stopped. After that, there are no problems for the Ottoman army in terms of their lines of communication and logistics. This does solve the problem. That's a great question.
And how many Armenians survived the trek to the desert?
I don't know.
I mean, a lot of them die along the way.
Yeah.
So.
You know, a lot of them die on the way. A lot of them die in camps. One of the great treasures for historians, which nobody has gotten into, there's a Turkish Red Cross called the Red Crescent, and in Turkish it's called Kızılay. And the Turkish Red Cross and Red Crescent does a lot of the work in the camps to defeat and house and take care of these people. Those records have never really been trolled by historians. Part of the answers are in those. The demographics and the counting of heads is contentious. The Turkish Jews tend to be on, for how many die, tend to be on the low side. The Armenian Jews tend to be on the high side. 350,000 is inclusive, in my view, inclusive of people who died in convoy in the camps. And in the turmoil of war, unrelated to the relocation. You know, when you're living in a combat zone and there's a battle in your front yard, certain civilians are going to die. And a lot of that happens as well. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't really know the answer. Any other questions?
Perry. Did the Armenians or other oppressed minorities within the Ottoman Empire derive any inspiration from Wilson's 14 points?
The Armenians and Kurds certainly. The Treaty of Sevres, the first treaty ending the Middle Eastern War, establishes an Armenia and establishes a Kurd state. That's basically thrown in the trash can after the Turkish War of Independence and replaced by the Treaty of Lausanne, which does not create those entities. They draw great inspiration from. There are a lot of Armenians living in America at this point, especially in Boston. They're very active. These are ARF, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation Committee members. And they're very active. There's a resurgence of Armenian activity from 1919 to 1923. There's an actual Republic of Armenia for a while in what's now Turkey that's crushed. It's kind of a long, complicated story, but that certainly is true. The Arabs, the Kurds, and the Armenians expect independence. In 1919, and they are terribly dissatisfied, as you know, when they don't get it. Yes, Mohammed.
Now, I think the words always change from counterinsurgency to terrorists to the non-state actors. A lot of time, counterinsurgency manuals and talks about right now winning hearts and minds, trying to, one of the ways of differentiating the people, getting separate from them to pursue their oppressive problems, to solve it. Was there any effort from the Ottoman Empire to get resolved those issues of Armenians and try to get them separate from those the world from their winning hearts?
Good question. Frankly, not a bit. They don't care a bit about hearts and minds. The kinetic operations, as you understand that word, that's what they do. They crush, extinguish the rebellion. So that is not in their operationalizing counterinsurgency at all. That's a good question. The results of these rebellions are also never final. They're never done. When they crush the guys in Yemen, 10 years later they come back. When they crush the Macedonians, 6 years later they come back. So maybe had they been some less heavy-handed, had they been more attuned to this, it might have been different. Like Clausewitz says, no war is ever done. And these people, they're like the Energizer Bunny. They just keep coming back and back and back. So in the end, it's a failed strategy. I mean, in the end, in many ways, the Ottoman Empire collapses. The war, and at the end of the war, it's done. But it probably would not have survived into the 20th century just because of this technique. They were going to lose in the end, I think. Any other questions?
So we might point out, this is with respect to Craig's point, the significance of the Ottoman Empire's loss of the Balkan territories, where we have, starting with Greece, the recognition of independent, well, at least independent in quotes, nation states, but who are aligned with various great powers. So the Ottoman Empire is seeing its western lands being lost to these nationalist type movements. So it seems to me that this would give inspiration to at least some of these Armenian insurgent committees, the hope that they might establish an Armenian nation state, the way that we had nation states formed in the Balkans, in the not really that much time previously.
So, Lynn is a specialist in Balkan history. This is a good point. They've lost the Balkan provinces, which are more important to them than Anatolia. And it's a catastrophe. What would happen to the United States today if we lost Idaho and Montana? Who cares? Nobody cares. Really? But what would happen if we lost Texas and Louisiana?
Still okay.
This is a catastrophe. You know, these were their most productive, most heavily populated, most heavily, highly educated provinces that they used in 1912. They lose us now Macedonia, they lose western Bulgaria, they lose northern Greece, and they lose Kosovo. And that is an absolute disaster. And this haunts the idea that, oh geez, it's going to happen again. They don't really care about Yemen so much, or Libya. They let Libya go. But they do care about the core Anatolian provinces. And that haunts them. That's a specter in their imagination.
And you have the Young Turk leadership is also predominated by refugees from the Balkans.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they know about this.
They know about this. So, it's not going to happen again. This is a reaction. They're spring-loaded in a way to say it's not going to happen again. Yeah. Enver comes from the Balkans. Mustafa Kemal, he's not part of this, but he comes from Thessaloniki. And there are a lot of these people. I'm willing to stick around if anybody has individual questions. So I thank you for your attention. If you want.